Welcome to Outspoken, where we dive deep into the topics and intersection of technology, money, business, and passion. I'm your host, Shayna Cosgrove.
Every company has data at this point. So thinking about how you are engineering it, harnessing it, using it to improve your business functions, it's a fun role to kind of bring the focus and attention of a company to that. We see kind of the emergence of machine learning analytics where you are using data to tease out patterns that you might not recognize as a human. And then once the machine kind of teases out that pattern, then goes and runs it in an automatic fashion. I was really, really drawn by the culture of the leadership team from an open, kind of safe, inclusive team, and just how that's pushed out across the team and enables us to collaborate.
Welcome, Stephanie. Thank you so much for taking time on your Sunday afternoon for giving your kids a movie to watch. What movie are they watching?
I save times like these. It's the movies that I can't stand to watch with them. So it is the 87th time that they're watching Sharkboy and Lava Girl.
Oh my God, that is the worst movie. I had to sit through it too.
Yeah.
That is a horrible movie.
Horrible movie.
Tell us about where you are professionally today.
Well, I am at Nyla, just celebrated, I guess, back in October, my first year at Nyla, and I am our chief data scientist, so that's been really a fun role to take on, and I've really enjoyed kind of over the past year kind of starting to feel like I know what I'm know what I'm doing and where I fit on the team.
Well, what the heck is a chief data scientist? It's not a common term. Are there a lot of chief data scientists out there in the world? Do you feel weird like being a chief data scientist?
I definitely see like a lot of government organizations adding that role across different organizations. You also see growth in the chief data officer role, just given like every company has data at this point. So thinking about how you are engineering it, harnessing it, using it to improve your business functions, it's a fun role to kind of bring the focus and attention of a company to that.
Now, what do you actually do at Nyla? What's your job look like at Nyla?
A lot of our focus is on finding organizations within the government or commercial entities that we're working with, finding business opportunities for us to support those organizations in a contracting role in the realm of data science. So I am looking at kind of where our company can grow business in the area of data science and AI and machine learning. And on the flip side of that, I'm looking for talent and trying to grow a team and mentor kind of the next generation of data scientists out there. And then on top of that, trying to maintain my own technical knowledge and stay current. And I've found it really beneficial to stay on contract and work with our government clients kind of hands on keyboard too.
Yeah. What's your current project like? What kind of work are you doing from a tech stack perspective? And what are some of the goals that you're working on contract?
On contract, it's been interesting. There's, you know, so many organizations, I think, that recognize that they would benefit from AI and machine learning. So often we get in there and they're not quite ready for us to just jump in with AI. There's a lot of things that need to happen with data and understanding the data that an organization has. I think we have an organization that we're working for right now that is open to AI solutions. And we are trying to develop the technology and then also mature the organization to trust the results of machine learning models and artificial intelligence.
Now, I would say you specialize in cyber analytics. Do you think that's accurate?
That's where I've probably spent the majority of my career, analytics and data that help us do better cybersecurity.
What the heck are analytics? It's like a great buzzword. What is analytics?
It's a wonderful overloaded term. That could be just simple like metrics and descriptive statistics on your data. If it's something that's kind of routinely built in and run over a data set, that could be an analytic. We see kind of the emergence of machine learning analytics where you are using data to tease out patterns that you might not recognize as a human. And then once the machine kind of teases out that pattern, then goes and runs it in an automatic fashion.
And those patterns are potentially teasing out attacks mm-hmm. that are called signatures or, you know, attack behaviors.
So there's like the wonderful, clean machine learning algorithms and analytics that you see out there that you have this beautiful data set that is labeled with pieces of data mean X, Y, and Z. And you can run those through a model and it will tell you, okay, well, we didn't know it about this data, but now we can label it with X, Y, and Z. In real life, we don't have a whole lot of that like clean, perfect data. And especially when it comes to cyber data, we have a lot of bits and bytes coming through and not necessarily a good idea of what it all means.
Where does the cyber data come from? Can you walk us through several different data sets that make up cybersecurity data?
Yeah, so we see a lot of data coming through that's kind of generated off of routers. So organizations have their own routers, and those can generate logs, those can generate network metadata. So IP1 talks to IP2 over these ports, so we can tell like you're receiving an email or something like that. We are not able to read your email, but we can see kind of record of that transaction, that kind of thing. In some cases, from a cybersecurity perspective for an organization, you might use that to say, okay, well, if emails are received from an IP from this country and it has over a certain number of bytes associated with it, then that might be something that's malicious or something that needs to be kind of blocked or spam filtered or something like that. We're tending to look at bigger patterns, not necessarily based on like an email address or something like that, that are traversing a network.
Sometimes even just getting the data into the system to be analyzed is quite a problem in itself.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different stages that data can step through where it becomes challenging. So from a sheer volume perspective, absolutely, like if the pipes that you have are not big enough to, or if your storage is not big enough, size is a huge issue, especially with cyber data in general.
How long is the raw data kept for typically?
It's going to be completely dependent on what the perceived purpose is and technical capacity. At this point, it's really how much money is an organization willing to pony up to store it, given kind of the current technologies.
I think of data science as a large effort where it's processing huge amounts of data. Typically, data is coming to some cloud, either put in a repository and then run across like credit card transactions, mm-hmm. or it's streaming as each transaction comes in. They're checking to see the potential validity or fraud of that transaction. Mm-hmm. Is a classic example of data science or machine learning. What about the future as we move to an increased mobile society and Internet of Things devices? And how do we do the processing at edge, right? So how mm-hmm. do we start pushing this knowledge into people's homes to prevent them from attacks as well? How do you see kind of that architecture transitioning towards everything coming in central to multiple processing at the edge where they don't have the full set of data at the edge?
What I've seen be successful is kind of a cyclical approach to development. And a lot of that is like, how much data can we get back centrally to analyze in bulk? Tease out what are the patterns? How much of it needs to be stored? What can we glean out of it? What do we need to put together with it to make more sense of it? A lot of that can happen kind of more in a research prototype manner in bulk centrally. And as you start to learn what your data is actually representing or what the cues might be, those types of signatures can be pushed back out to the edges.
You're telling me that edge processing is more tactical.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
How stable is data in general? How often does the formatting or the metadata of the data remains stagnant so that it's stable?
I am a huge proponent of keep it somewhere in its raw form. I think we see a lot of people And a lot of organizations try to push these ontologies or data schemas and try to force.
I mean, people make whole careers.
Right.
On,
yes. Yeah.
There are literally hundreds of people around the Beltway, and we don't, Stephanie doesn't mean to offend you, but
well,
and they are spending their career on ontologies. They're literally running around, like sitting in meetings, going over one organization's ontology and meaning and purpose, and then coming up with an agreed upon ontology and trying to push it back down throughout the organization and all future development, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think those skills absolutely have their place from a data science perspective. Yeah. You know, I can always spin it.
What are the problems that really excite you professionally that you are looking forward to working on?
Honestly, kind of finding and developing new junior data scientists and even maybe more senior ones too. The team aspect of this, the opportunity to live vicariously and geek out through the rest of the team that's doing this type of work in this industry. That's been what gets me out of bed.
Is data science a team sport?
Everything about data science is multidisciplinary. You need to have a really solid mathematical, statistical component to that. Obviously, a software development, computer science, engineering capability. You need to have good consulting and communication skills because you're oftentimes trying to communicate very complex solutions. The people that have like all of those skills, like those are really tough people to find. So kind of knowing where your strengths are with respect to data science and where others are, it's always better when it's supported from a team perspective.
When you were little, did you dream that you were going to grow up and be a data scientist working on cybersecurity problems?
If I like reflect on it now, I was definitely kind of trending in this direction. I was actually thinking about it recently, just kind of given like the current state of the world. But I mean, I think like 9/11 honestly had a huge impact on where I took my career. Being able to kind of find this career path that allowed me to make use of my technical skills, but also using them for good and where I can apply them to protect the nation and that sort of thing. That was ingrained in me pretty much from 9/11.
How so was that from 9/11? Was there a special discussion about it? Where did you grow up? Were you near New York?
Yeah, I actually grew up in Connecticut.
Now, were either one of your parents involved in federal work at all? So how did this sort of patriotism, outside of seeing 9/11, how did this desire to work in the government space come about?
My parents did not. They're both super mathy, sciencey folks. So I definitely got those genes from my dad's a PhD chemist, retired, and my mom is an accountant.
What kind of chemistry did your father do for a living? What was his job?
He taught after getting his PhD for a while. And then he went to work at Polaroid for a while. And then as Polaroid kind of popularity declined and everything, he moved into pharmaceuticals. So he did a lot of research and development, like statistical studies and everything around developing new drugs.
And what about your mother? Did she work your whole childhood?
She did. She was definitely part-time when we were younger and worked from home for some time. But yeah, she worked for as long as I can remember, yeah.
What was her college major?
French. She went back to school for accounting, but she also received a degree in French. And she's actually been able to use it a bit in her career as well from some of the business work that she's done.
How did they influence you and your degree growing up? Was your father hoping you were going to be a chemist?
It's this thing that I'm like super conscious of right now with my kids because I love math. I definitely remember, like, as I got into high school, him being super excited about my chemistry. And, you know, a PhD chemist, like, you ask a real simple chemistry question and you get a dissertation for a response about it. So I loved chemistry, mostly because there's a ton of math in chemistry. But I definitely didn't head down that path. I honestly very much resisted going down the math track.
Why?
So, I think I wasn't completely certain I wanted to be a math teacher. I did kind of go down that path from a college degree. So I will tell you, I started out, I was a music industry major my first semester of college.
Dude, my mind is blown. First of all, I didn't even know you were one into music. Two, if you even play an instrument. Do you play an instrument?
I play many adequately. I'm kind of a jack of all trades with musical instruments.
What's your primary instrument?
Piano, I would say at this point.
How the hell did I not know this? You're a piano player.
Yeah.
Are you good?
From my perspective, adequate.
Yeah. Were you in marching band too?
Uh-huh.
What instrument were you in marching band?
My first instrument that I ever learned to play was accordion. I was picking up an accordion right around the time of the show Family Matters with Steve Urkel.
Question, how does a young girl find an accordion to pick up and play with? Where was this accordion?
My parents got some random like marketing call from a local music center that was giving instruction. And I told them, this is kindergarten. I was like, yes, I want to play the saxophone like Lisa Simpson. And
yeah, they said,
absolutely not. You do not have enough wind as a kindergartner to blow through a saxophone. But we do specialize in accordion. So they were like, here you go. Try accordion.
I can't imagine. Isn't it heavy?
They size up as you grow.
Oh my God, there's little accordions. Do you still have it?
Mm-mm, I don't. I do wish I'd still have
it. Oh my God, how cute would that be?
Yeah, because my daughter, I don't think she even necessarily realizes that I used to play. She randomly was asking about accordion playing.
So where do you go off to college?
I was like pretty adamant that I wanted to go to college out of state. I did my first semester at Northeastern University in Boston.
And Northeastern is great for music, right?
Yeah, so I loved music. But I never like really fully committed to an instrument. So I was never like strong enough in any one instrument to kind of go for a performance degree.
So you go off to college and you're a music industry major for only one semester.
Yep.
What happens?
I decided not to continue at Northeastern. I very much learned about myself in that situation that I am not a city girl. And Northeastern is like right downtown Boston in the middle of everything. I love Boston as a city and visiting it, but I just felt like I was on edge all the time.
You grew up in a special place. You didn't just grow up in Connecticut. The town where you grew up is special.
So the town I grew up in, New Milford, Connecticut, it's like very quintessential kind of New England town, but it's cool because it's one of the three towns that the Gilmore Girls was modeled after. So it's been part of kind of the Gilmore Girls festivals that still continue every year. And Gilmore Girls was fun because Rory, the main character, she was actually like literally at the exact same grade level as I was at the time. And she went off to private school the same year that I went off to boarding school for a year. So I'm an ice hockey goalie. And at the time in Connecticut, there was no girls hockey really. There were two girls hockey teams in the entire state. And if you played on one of them, you had to travel out of state pretty much like every weekend, every other weekend to compete. The other kind of path for girls hockey at the time was the private boarding schools in the area had very, very high level ice hockey teams that were kind of feeding into the Division I college programs.
So you're in the center of the city and you're like, not for me, not loving this.
Yep.
And where do you go?
So I went home for a semester, actually. I moved back home and did community college classes and worked and spent kind of my second semester, my freshman year at home. So not majoring in anything, just kind of taking classes. I don't really remember kind of what flipped the switch for the music industry major. I think a lot of it was, I think I realized I was like definitely not cut out for the music industry, like very obviously kind of cutthroat. And I am not. So I actually ended up going to school at Quinnipiac University my sophomore year, which is in Connecticut, right down the road from Yale. So not too far from home and everything. But I walked on to their Division I women's ice hockey team. So even though I was close to home, I was really didn't have time to be home very often.
Is that where you graduated from?
I did. I got my bachelor's degree.
In what?
In math. When I first started there, I was doing a dual major. You could do a master's while working on your bachelor's there. So I was doing a master's in elementary ed while majoring in psychology. And then I finally like moved myself over to major in math and was working on a master's in secondary. education and a few credits shy of my master's in secondary ed, I decided that I was going to go to grad school for math too.
I am smiling because you literally do sound like the very definition of a data scientist. To study the psychology, yeah. To be so interested in that, to end up majoring in math, you're focused on collaboration yeah. versus individuation and individual performance. But who's giving you guidance at this time? Like, where are you making these major life decisions?
My parents were like so great, even with the music industry major. There were two things my parents completely vetoed when I was looking at colleges. I really wanted to check out Pepperdine in California. They're like, heck no.
Well, it's also very expensive.
Yeah. And then I was looking at a school in Boston, Berklee College of Music.
Oh, of course.
You know, we would rather you go to a university for when you finally change your mind. They didn't say it that way, obviously. But they were like, go somewhere where you're going to have some more options kind of thing.
Well, so, Berklee's really intense. It's yeah. one of the top music programs yeah. in the U.S.
They were just like very consistently supportive of all the changes. but yeah, they really didn't try to like pressure me one way or the other. I think I had really good advisors in college. I had a professor that I was really close with.
In math, I'm guessing.
In math, yeah. It was like right when I changed to the math major, which I had come to by like taking, I took chemistry for majors, even though I didn't have to, for my science credit, because I just knew it was going to be all math and was annoying to the chemistry majors who were struggling with it since I wasn't majoring in it. And then I took statistics for my psychology major at the time.
Yeah.
And I was like, come on, what are you doing? Like, just go get the math degree.
What kind of computer science work did you have to do while you were in college? Any?
I was a pure math major, which in like hindsight, when I got to grad school, was a poor choice. But I stuck with this pure math track. I actually did very little computer science. It wasn't until my internship with DoD where I was introduced to Java on the job as my literally first coding experience.
But I think that was normal at that time. I don't think computer literacy or programming literacy was common when you went off to college. I think now almost every single degree program probably has to have some understanding of computer literacy or how computers are processing their information. Mm-hmm. But when I was at college, the math majors could have been a pure math major as well. And they didn't even have a computer science 101 for non-engineering. So I don't think that that's surprising. So you go off and you decide you're going to get a graduate degree in math. Why? Why not just go work?
I definitely considered that as well. And as I finished my bachelor's degree, I was not going to be able to enroll in a grad program the following fall. I actually interviewed for and received an offer to go be a math teacher at a New England boarding school and be a hockey coach and a high school math teacher. And it was very, very enticing coming out of college to have this full-time job that seemed like a, you know, perfect fit for me and everything. But I had already kind of expressed interest in going towards the PhD in math. And my parents really kind of encouraged me to hang for basically a year. I mean, I was productive. I did a program at Penn State in between undergrad and grad school called the Mathematics Advanced Studies Semester, which was run at the time by these Russian professors, and they taught it like it was in Russia, we do all of our math theorems in pen, and if we mess it up, we rip it up and we start over. It was intense. All of our exams at the end were oral exams where, you know, you just stood up at the front of the room and the professor asked you questions that you had to explain on the chalkboard on the spot.
Wow, that's great training.
It was.
That's really great training.
I was accepted to a PhD program at Texas A&M. I did my first year in that program, and then I got an internship, summer internship in the grad math program at NSA. Loved it and was like, okay, I'm going to take my master's and get back to work.
Why did you love it? Well, what about it was so wonderful to you?
The one thing that really struck me as a grad student about that type of work specifically was I literally could not take work home with me. You're not allowed to.
That was not the answer I was expecting.
No, it was so great. Like going from, you know, classes and doing homework, you know, all evening and weekends and studying and all this stuff. And then for a summer, I showed up to work. I put in my hours. And when my hours were done, I would go home and I literally couldn't take work home with me.
Now, tell me, how long did you work for the agency?
As an employee, just that summer internship. That was it.
Oh, that was it?
Yep.
Why didn't you go back to be a government civilian?
Tell
the truth. This is a money. We also talk about money here.
Yeah, no, I actually, and I've raised this because I've, you know, encountered folks on the government side, even now, obviously, they have an amazing program for math graduates and it's extremely rigorous. There's testing involved. You show up and do like a standardized test. There's interviews where you're, you know, getting up to a whiteboard and working out math problems and stuff. I gave a lecture in the building for my interviews and everything. And I, at the time, was accepted for a position there. And there were, from a government side, not billets available. So I couldn't kind of hang out and wait after graduating. So I actually fully expected to be a government employee when I graduated and was lucky to find kind of the government contracting world. I think there's pros and cons from a career perspective. There are development programs on the government side that allow you to be exposed to a lot of different development programs that allow you to try a lot of different offices and missions out to see what's a good fit for you. On the government contracting side, there's so much of the consulting piece of that, of going out and talking to clients and getting buy-in and presenting ideas and that sort of thing, that I don't think would have been able to do as early in my career on the government side.
This podcast is sponsored by Nyla Technology Solutions, an SBA-certified 8A, HubZone, woman-owned small business specializing in full-stack software engineering and data science services to the U.S. government. Our innovative solutions are built to match the speed of mission. For more information, partnering opportunities, and new job openings, please visit our website, www.nyla.io. In computer science, there tends to remain about a 10, maybe 20% maximum number of female identifying graduates. Mm-hmm. What was your experience in math, being a woman in math, in the undergraduate and graduate programs?
Yeah, definitely in the minority. Absolutely.
At what percentage? Let's talk statistics, yeah, and percentages. What percentage?
Yeah, I would say maybe like 5 to 10% of the department was female.
For graduate?
For graduate, yeah.
Were there any educators who were female?
Yes. Yeah, I definitely had. Actually, my advisor was a woman. And actually, my favorite college professor at Quinnipiac was a woman mathematician as well.
How many female math majors did you graduate with your undergraduate degree?
I definitely in the minority. I was lucky. My roommate on my hockey team was also a math major. She and I kind of buddied up. But I think also somewhat because it was a teaching school too, there was more of a balance for math majors there. I do remember we had this tiny, tiny computer science department. And I very distinctly remember there being at graduation, like one, maybe two women in computer science at my school.
Now, from where I sit, I feel like I see a lot more women majoring in math, mm-hmm, than any other technical program. I think math seems to remain consistent or growing, and cybersecurity seems to have a lot of women in, mm-hmm, it as well. I don't know if that's because it's more tactically focused, mm-hmm, or it clearly exciting defense problem focused. That's my theory. Why do you think there are more women in math than computer science?
Honestly, my like first gut reaction is that it's surrounding teaching careers in math. I think there is math tricky from a major perspective because graduating with a math degree is still challenging to understand what career opportunities are out there. For everybody, you know, gets excited about, oh, you have a math degree or it's a STEM field and everything. But there really aren't that many like jobs that are listed as a, we're looking for a mathematician, you know? I think teaching is absolutely like kind of a clear-cut field you can go into with a math degree, absolutely.
There seem to be a number of women in data science. What do you think the percentage of women in data science is from your experience?
High percentage, like closer to 50-50.
Yeah.
And I do think a lot of it has to do with that multidisciplinary blend. And you see people coming into data science through a lot of different paths. So you see a lot of the engineering folks, math and stats folks, but you also see a lot of data scientists developing out of some of the social sciences. So where you would see a higher concentration, I think, of women. I love looking at the breadth of college degrees that I've seen for data science. One of my favorite colleagues when I was at Booz Allen, it was a wildlife or forestry sciences major. Physicists make amazing data scientists from what I've seen.
Also programmers. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just kind of all over the place, I would say.
Now, when did you officially hear the term data scientist and apply it to yourself? How did that evolution come about?
I started hearing about the term and the field, I would say, not long after I entered the workforce. 2011, 2012 would be kind of the start of it as a term, data science. I resisted the title data scientist for a long time because it honestly, like, it's so buzzwordy.
What was your title?
So my first title, I was on a software development team that was also painful because I'm like, oh gosh, I hope you didn't hire me to be a software developer. But I mean, I was very intentionally hired as a math person onto a software development team to start to bring that blend together for data science type work. I definitely resisted the label. But at this point, I feel like it is accurate. I do still see a lot of people throw that title on their signature block and email where I'm like,
well, that's because it's high paying too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's a high paying field. That's one of the things I think is most exciting about it is they say that as fields become dominated by women, they tend to become lower paying. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I love about data science is, though it seems anecdotally to be relatively equal in gender or gender identifying, it is a very extraordinarily high paying career field.
Yes.
On par with software engineers.
Yes, absolutely.
How much training have you had to do outside of the job or during the job to remain relevant and keep your skills current, right? You still, from your graduate degree, have very little programming courses at this time as well.
After I finished that summer internship, I did go back to grad school and took all of the electives that I could toward computer science classes.
What'd you take? Tell me all about it.
For some reason, like the two big graduate level courses that were more introductory, one was just straight up C++ and the other
one, good.
For some reason, was Java and C, which don't
blend.
It made me appreciate Java starting with, I think we did the first half of the semester in C and the second in Java, which I'd already had a light intro to.
So you left Booz Allen and you came to NYLA. Tell me what you were looking for and why NYLA was an attractive option to you.
I think given kind of where I was in my career, I was looking for ways to challenge myself. Something that's been of interest to me was definitely the small business aspect that NYLA brought. I had a really wonderful experience and career at Booz Allen, but it's a huge company. And just getting to know kind of inner workings of how a business runs on top of kind of the technical work and everything and being more involved in kind of the growth and the culture of a business. A 100-year-old company, making change to the culture is an extremely slow process. And me having any influence on that, can't imagine how I would be able to accomplish that.
You know, you have this great professional experience, great demeanor, and every company must have been vying for you to come work for them. So how did you go about examining companies and making that decision? And what stood out about NYLA to you?
For me with NYLA, and something that I had recognized even while I was at Booz Allen, I'm an athlete still, and I always enjoyed work as a team sport. you know, a work hard, play hard kind of thing. So I was definitely looking for a company that I could feel like I was part of the team. The research I'd done, the folks at Nyla that I'd been introduced to before I decided to join, like I felt like there was a really good kind of team personality fit, culture fit. You probably remember as I was coming on, like my interest in kind of like what I was going to be doing from a contract perspective, I'm not super picky. It's more of a like, just give me some space to run. I'll figure it out from there kind of thing. But it was much more of the team and culture. I was really, really drawn by the culture of the leadership team from an open, kind of safe, inclusive team, and just how that's pushed out across the team and enables us to collaborate, innovate. I definitely attended kind of a summer picnic where I got to meet just a huge number of employees from the company and see them all there with their families. And it was kind of an immediate, like, okay, I can see myself here on top of kind of the work that we do and the clients and missions that we support.
So how do you get a sense of culture from a company just from interviewing? What is it that is so subtle that gives you these indicators that it might be a good fit for you? What were you looking for?
I mean, for me with Nyla, I think it was looking at kind of the activities and behaviors outside of just strictly what contracts the company is supporting and working on. So there was a lot of work being done from a charities and local community perspective that really says something to me about how the business is organized and run. I mean, certainly I was really driven to go work for a woman-owned and run company. So that's exciting to me.
Has it lived up to your expectations?
Absolutely. I honestly was talking to a male colleague yesterday from Nyla that he was saying to me, like, he sought out a woman-owned company because he feels like it's an environment where we just naturally tend to care for employees more. It's nice to hear it from the opposite sex too, but I definitely, like, just given what we've done during COVID, it's different and it's caring. Like, we got little care packages, cookies and masks and hand sanitizer, useful things, but also just like comforting things too. You're stuck at home. Here's a cookie.
You know, it's very interesting to me to hear it reflected back. And I have a hard time because I am part of creating the culture, creating the vision. So I don't know if it's working or not, right? Like, I have this idea of what we're going to do. And it's interesting hearing how you saw it from before attending and coming in. And then quite honestly, being a woman in tech and having such a strong career of being told you're unlikable, that you're not smart, which equates to you're not technical, and that women are terrible bosses and that women are terrible to each other. I mean, I experienced all of those things said to me directly, inferred, and it's interesting to hear you today say, well, I specifically sought it out.
Yep.
It wasn't, oh, I was afraid to join you because you were a woman and women are terrible to each other.
I honestly, it's funny you mentioned that, but that was how I felt growing up. I avoided a lot of female friendships growing up and stuck with the guys. Like, I felt like it was much more straightforward to have guy friends. And I did a lot of activities, ice hockey included, were like very, and math. Like, I really spent most of my time with the guys. But it's been nice, like, really in the last like 5 to 10 years, I feel like from a networking perspective, I've just met a lot of really wonderful, like, female colleagues that are technical leaders. And that's kind of really changed my perspective on, and my approach to working with folks too.
I really personally had to work so much on the story that I was telling myself for so long, was that no one wanted to work for a woman. And it was really hard for me to start the business because I was straight out told that to my face. Mm-hmm. No one wants to work for a woman. No one wants to work for you. You're super emasculating. Women are terrible to each other, right? So, like, mm-hmm. I couldn't even win with women, right? Like, not only would no man want to work for you, but no woman would want to work for you either because you're horrible. So it's very exciting to hear that your experience, that is not the case.
Yeah.
And I do think the thing we are strongest at that makes me the proudest is our company has a greater diversity of technical talent across gender and skin color, ethnic background, racial background than other companies. And I think that is completely reflective of the way that we communicate.
I will tell you, when I was looking at other companies, there were companies who I would pull up their website and I'd just see a bunch of white male faces. I've seen so much value over my experience to diverse teams, and it's more challenging and it takes more effort to include people with differing backgrounds and experiences and everything, but it brings out such a much more robust and well thought out and well envisioned final product.
And I think from that experience with the executive team as well, we definitely don't always agree. We have these varying points of view, and people definitely feel safe to bring them up. And we aren't great at poker faces. I don't think any of us are great at our poker face, but it's not rejected. And sometimes it has to be marinated on, and maybe the way you delivered it, you being general person, was not as neutral as it perhaps should be among a bigger crowd. You know, maybe you did deliver some bad news in a very pointed, acerbic way, but that's okay. We need to hear these things. We need to hear these differing point of views to make an end result that is much better for all of us, not only our employees, which are the most important, but also our clients. Yep. And I think that that culture leads to the innovation of people feeling free to speak up and to let their voice be heard, know it will be acknowledged, yep, and fused into the product overall. Before we go, what advice do you have for young people who are entering technology today?
I always talk about it as like a, you can choose to use your powers for good. I think there's so many industries where you can go and use software and data science skills and make just a buttload of money. But the career satisfaction of going to work and actually, what I'll say, using your powers for good very generally, because I think there's a ton of fields out there that you can apply those skills to, I would seek out those. And then on top of that, I gave no thought when I was entering the workforce and very much lucked out, but company culture, giving consideration to that, the people that you're working for and what they're trying to build, like that is such a huge, huge piece of, to me, from a career satisfaction perspective.
What is your favorite book that has impacted you?
I really enjoy like post-apocalyptic fiction. Like, I really loved the Silo series. There's the first one's called Wool, and it's Hugh Howey. He originally wrote them and released them, I think, as short stories that kind of all fit together.
Why are you into it? What appeals to it?
It's somewhat, I think, of interest to me from like just like it's an overall life approach thing of like I am constantly trying to imagine not necessarily like one specific path for the future, but like I love to just like in my brain explore like all the possible paths, all the possible things that could happen. And then I try to calculate the probability of that thing happening. I've read some good leadership books too. There's one called Maestro that I read fairly recently that I found really interesting of like just kind of how to balance across organizations like and skill sets and run the most efficiently. And I think especially because it ties into the music theme too. Like it's literally talking about organizations in the context of like conducting an orchestra.
Well, one of my final questions is, what is something about you that might surprise us?
I don't know if this is surprising or not. I absolutely consider myself an introvert. I like to say that I am an introvert pretending to be an extrovert. So
that's interesting.
I enjoy getting out there and talking to people and stuff like that, but I find that I always need to recharge. Like it takes a lot of energy, internal energy, to put out that.
That's so interesting because I thought you were a natural extrovert and everyone assumes I'm an extrovert. I think just because I talk a lot. But
maybe that's my problem too.
What is your experience with me? Do you think I'm an extrovert?
having gotten to know you over the past year, I kind of think you're not necessarily, but yeah, same deal. Like, maybe that's why we get along.
Yeah, I definitely need alone time to recharge, but Brian is full extrovert.
Yeah, he's full extrovert for sure.
Whoa. And then my son is full extrovert. I am so grateful that you are part of the Nyla team. And I thank you so much for sharing your story. And it is very interesting. You left me with a lot of surprises throughout. And it is reflective and exciting to hear the story of what a data scientist is today and what a chief data scientist is, particularly as data becomes more and more critical as it relates to cybersecurity, right? Data is the crown jewels of an organization. Mm-hmm. What can we learn from it? And as machine learning and artificial intelligence gets even more important. So thank you so much, Stephanie, for taking the time. Hopefully the movie is over. You don't have to watch it.
Yeah, I can hear them stomping around down there. So.
Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. Please be sure to share it with friends and family. If you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn under the Outspoken Podcast. Thanks again, and chin up, heads up, eyes forward.